You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, brought to you by Full Sneak Gear. Check out their entire lineup at fullsneakgear.com. Also, be sure to check out our entire stable of podcasts at sportsmansempire.com. Bowtech Archery prides themselves on offering a bow for everyone. Whether you have a short draw length, a long draw length, pull 70 pounds or 40 pounds, you're a bow hunter or a target archer, they offer a bow that can be customized to fit your body type. On top of that, their deadlock technology allows you to fine-tune your arrow flight. Visit bowtecharchery.com and check out the SR350 and the CP28. Bowtech Archery, refuse to follow. This is the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast, brought to you by Vortex Optics. What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of the Nine Finger Chronicles, and today is day one of Hunt Stand Week. And so what we're going to be doing this week is all three episodes, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, are going to be conversations with people who are connected to Hunt Stand, who write for Hunt Stand, who work for Hunt Stand, who are affiliated with Hunt Stand in some way, shape, or form. Now, this isn't going to be a conversation that is specifically about how Hunt Stand works, right? It's not going to be, it's going to be conversations with guys like today's guest. We're talking with Mark Kaiser, and Mark is a hardcore hunter. He's a writer. He does some work for Hunt Stand. He uses it. And we talk a little bit about strategy. We talk a little bit about, I guess, how he got into hunting. And we talk about hunting whitetails. We talk about out west, you know, his hunting adventures out west. So it's a really fun, entertaining, and educational podcast. And so you kind of get everything in this episode. And I hopefully you guys enjoy it. And like I said, it's Hunt Stand Week. So, you know, I'm going to sit here and tell you, if you are not a Hunt Stand user, I strongly suggest it for multiple reasons, right? Number one, if you're the kind of guy who is looking for value to me is, you know, the amount it costs. Hunt Stand is like $30 for their package. You can download it for free anywhere that you download apps. It's free to download, but then if you want to upgrade, you can upgrade to their main package for like $30 a year. That's it, $30 a year. Some of the competition is like $140, I believe, dollars a year or higher. And so you're really saving $100, but you're not losing any functionality. You're actually gaining it. It has tons of functionality for just about any type of hunter, right? Whether you're looking for, you know, just to pin, you know, put pins, whether you're looking to mark out food plots, whether you're looking for here's what I'll say. It's my job to tell you to go to huntstand.com and read up on all the functionality that that Hunt Stand offers. So go check out Hunt Stand, right? And I think we're still offering a discount code SN20 for 20% off. So you get that discount code as well. Go check out Hunt Stand. The capabilities and functionalities are awesome for someone who wants to journal and document their time spent in the woods. So you can go do that. Now, there's some other companies that I got to talk about today. Commercials, Tethered. If you're looking for a saddle, go check out Tethered. The best part about Tethered is that they are a one-stop shop for all of your saddle hunting needs. And I know that sounds like some dumb written like push, it is, but they are, if that makes sense. They are the one-stop shop, not only for the platforms, the saddles, the climbing sticks, the all the accessories you need, but also for the information on how to become a better saddle hunter. And you get all that with Tethered. So go check out Tethered's website. Wasp Archeries. Again, I don't know why, but every time I bring up Wasp broadheads, I visualize Metallica playing in the background. Just this implement of destruction, and anything that they hit, they destroy. And I am a huge fan of Wasp broadheads, not only because of the people who work there, but because they're made, a majority of their heads are made in America with an awesome design that works and with the best possible materials. And so you add those three things up on top of their customer service, and what you have is a product that I am very confident with. So if you're looking for a broadhead, look no further than Wasp. I'm telling you, I think you'll be pleased. And we have a discount code for them, NFC20, and that's going to save you 20% off with Wasp broadheads. And lastly, title sponsor, Vortex Optics. If you're looking for a rifle scope, if you're looking for a red dot, if you're looking for a rangefinder, a pair of binoculars, a spotting scope, go check out Vortex. The best part about Vortex is their VIP warranty. So if you damage your product in the field, I'm very hard on my equipment. I drag my stuff all over the place. And if it breaks, you send it to them. They fix it for free and then ship it back to you. On top of that, they have an awesome apparel line that you guys all need to go check out, vortexoptics.com. And now we can get into the very first episode of Hunt Stand Week with our friend Mark Kaiser. Hopefully you guys enjoy. 3, 2, 1. All right. On the very first episode of Hunt Stand Week, I am joined by Mark Kaiser. Mark, how we doing, man?
Good. So it's almost hunting season. So, yeah. Well, it is hunting
season. It is hunting season. Right, right. I know there's a lot of guys out west starting the process. Some of them have been antelope hunting. Some of them have been, I don't know if today marks maybe opener of elk in some states.
Colorado might. There's a few that might. September 1st is the big opener, and then Montana opens the 3rd of September.
3rd, okay. All right, gotcha. I don't know, I feel like the only reason I know this is because of email exchanges that we've had, but it sounds to me like you're getting ready to kick off a big elk push here pretty soon.
Yeah, I go back to back on elk pretty hard for the next, you could say almost 2 months, but I'll have a little bit of a break in there depending on success. And I'm helping some other guys, so I'll be jumping around from my hunts to their hunts. But I'm actually packing my trailer right now at this very minute. Well, I was shooting rifles right before I came in to do this, and then I'm packing my trailer to leave out in the morning to put an elk camp in and then start on the Montana opener on the 3rd of September, just this coming Saturday.
Nice, nice. So it sounds like you have a very full fall coming your way.
Yeah, it's full. It's probably fuller than it needs to be, and I blame myself. But
yeah,
I do a lot of DIY hunting, especially for elk, and that is very time consuming. Unless you got some type of honey hole or drew a premier tag, which is hard to draw, but a premier tag where there's not that many hunters, if you're doing general units or units where there's a lot of hunting pressure on public land, you really have got to put the time and effort in. And so that's where I eat up a lot of my time. And then I love the Midwest whitetail hunt. So I try to carve out a little niche of November, or maybe more than a little, but half of November to do that. I hook up with some friends of mine, hunt Kansas, and I come back up into South Dakota and finish up there. So
nice, nice. Yeah, this for me, I usually go on one out-of-state trip, and usually that's a Western game like mule deer or elk, and then I come back and I hunt Iowa. This year, well, I shouldn't say that. The last 2 years, I've really tried to add in a second mule deer stop somewhere along the lines, just because I'm slowly becoming infatuated with mule deer, and so I've just kind of put elk to the side for the time being and just started collecting preference points. And so focusing on the DIY public side of mule deer hunting, and then probably picking up another whitetail state this year. And the reason I'm doing that is because I've been a really good husband and father the last 10 months. And so, my brownie pump points are at an all time high.
That's important. Yeah. And chasing mule deer is probably, I mean, I'm kind of stuck on elk, but it's a higher priority because yeah. that's a seems to be a declining species. They're having a hard go of it, and in our neck of the woods here, the mountain mule deer population is just disappearing to no end. You find good pockets of mule deer yet on private land, but I do a lot of shed hunting in the mountains in the spring, and the last couple of years, I just haven't been finding any mature or any mule deer sheds whatsoever.
Yeah. So that's something I wouldn't mind digging into, and you're a Western guy, right? So just let everybody know where you live or what region of the U.S. you live.
I live on the up along the Front Range of the Bighorn Mountains, and those are in north central Wyoming, and I live right on the Montana border. So I hunt Montana and Wyoming a lot.
Gotcha.
In fact, I hunt them almost as much each. Even though Wyoming's my home state, I spent a lot of time in Montana.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
But I grew up in South Dakota, and I grew up in corn country. So I have this, you know, really, I have an infatuation with whitetails. I go back every fall, like I said, and hunt whitetails. And I'm really tuned into Kansas right now as my big whitetail hotspot. So,
yeah.
But elk eat at me. If I'm not looking for shed antlers in the spring, I'm hunting them in the fall and scouting them in the summer.
Yeah. So the reason I ask that is to put in a little, I feel like here in Iowa, and there's other places in the Midwest that we'll run into a big spout of EHD, right? It'll wipe a herd out or it'll reduce it. And then a year or two later, they just seem to rebound from it. And, you know, things are cyclical, but they always kind of come back to a good spot. But what you've mentioned out west about mule deer and the mountain mule deer, and I've heard this from other people too, from your experience out in the field, what is it about maybe or even the elk population? Because I feel like I've heard guys talk about certain elk populations not doing as well either. What is it about the West that I feel the herd health or the herd of mule deer or elk is just a little bit more fragile?
Well, I'll clarify one thing. Elk are doing fairly well in most states. So I wouldn't necessarily throw elk into there, but mule deer, if you study evolution and look at the history of mule deer, look at the history of whitetails, look at the history of elk. Elk were spread across the United States from coast to coast and from the tundra down almost to the, you know, into Mexico. So they're a very adaptable species. Mule deer, on the other hand, evolved in a very niche species like pronghorn. So when things change in their backyard, it really affects them. Whitetails, same thing. They're very adaptable like a elk. And whitetails have pushed into mule deer country because of the greening of the West. You know, we've carved out pathways for them beyond the riparian zones where they were found there during, you know, the Lewis and Clark journals illustrate that there were whitetails out in the West. But the more greenways you make north or west and north, the faster they can expand. Mule deer just have a tough time. So when energy exploration, urbanization, suburbanization, the aging of the sagebrush community, wildfires, lack of wildfires, drought, maybe too much rain, which I don't think you can ever have out west, but there's a group called the Mule Deer Working Group, and it's a bunch of wildlife agencies in the West, and they meet every year or more than once probably, but to share their thoughts. And they've got over a dozen factors that are affecting why mule deer are not an expanding population right now. In some areas they are, but as an overall group across the West, there could be trouble ahead for mule deer.
Yeah.
And you just can't lay blame on one thing. You can't just say, oh, it's coyotes eating the fawns, which they do, but you can't just say it. That's one factor. It's all an intertwining bunch of factors.
Right. Right. Which kind of surprises me, because I heard a fact about mule deer that, that I don't know, I thought was very interesting. And from my understanding, a white-tailed deer has the ability to consume, I think, somewhere around 250 different, plant varietals. And meaning they can eat 250-ish different types of plants and trees and things like that. Out in the mule deer world, I heard that they have the ability to eat somewhere like over 400 different varietals of plants. And so that tells me that that allows them to eat more types of food, and then just them being in these harsh, whether you're, you know, these harsher environments, whether you're, you know, over 10,000 feet, whether you're in the plains or the rain, like the northern plains or western plains, where some may consider that kind of like an arid environment, all the way down to Mexico, where these animals are living in straight up desert conditions. And so it blows my mind that they're more fragile than the whitetail is.
But again, that's a long, narrow niche strip of habitat compared to going from, there's whitetails, I would bet now, in 49 of the 50 states. And I've heard a lot of biologists saying that it's just a matter of years before they make it to Alaska. Cause I've actually seen them right on the border of the Northwest Territories when we've been bear hunting.
Yeah.
So in Alberta, right on the border. And I know guys that tell me, well, I shouldn't say guys. I've interviewed biologists up there. They've seen them, and you know they're documented in the Northwest Territory. So it's, but one of the things is all those varieties of forage, forbs, browse you're talking about, have been changing too. And one of the big things that changes them is the smoky bear syndrome, where there's no wildfire spreading across the landscape every 3 to 4 or 5 years, you know, renewing that sagebrush community or foothill community of browse. And I see it here, you know, in the winter, and we have hard winters right in my horse pasture. Those deer have a hard time because the sagebrush is so old and decrepit that it just doesn't give them as much nutrients as they would be getting had it been burned over, you know, several times over the last 20 years.
Yeah, things are definitely changing. So I kind of want to, talk to us. This is Hunt Stand Week on the Nine Finger Chronicles, and I want to talk to you a little bit about your involvement with Hunt Stand. What do you do for Hunt Stand? I was talking to our mutual friend Tim Kent, and it sounds like you do a lot for them. You do some writing for them. What's your role within that organization?
Well, I'm a writer by trade, so I write hunting articles and do the photography for it, and that's kind of transitioned into a little bit of influencing now. That's what they call it. It used to be branding, marketing, and branding.
Right.
So I work with, I've been a trusted Hunt Stand user for years. The guys at Hunt Stand knew that. I knew them, when they were, some of them were first starting at Hunt Stand. So we just kind of teamed up together, and they know that I use it a lot, whether I'm doing whitetail hunting in the Midwest, predator hunting here in, out in the prairies of Wyoming or the Great Plains, or, up in the mountains doing elk hunting. I use it in different aspects, depending on the hunts. But in fact, this morning I downloaded 2 maps to my smartphone just so I had them, obviously, on this next elk trip so I could refer to them quick, because where I'm going to be, it's odds are pretty low I'm going to have connectivity to them.
Right.
Anywhere where there's a cell tower. Every once in a while I get up high enough on a peak I can grab some service, but having that function alone is really good. It's great even in the Midwest if you're down in a hollow or coulee hunting, you got a tree stand down there and you can't get line of sight to a cell tower. At least you got the map there on your phone. You can still do what you need to do on the hunting app.
Yeah Let's talk about this, the way you use it, because I feel like it's a tool Like, these digital maps are such a great tool for people, not only just for like the mapping aspect of it, but the way I use digital maps is for the journaling aspect of it. Like, it's almost like keeping a journal and then being able to go back and reference your journal as the season progresses, or you're looking back on historic data or whatever. You're in the field a lot. Sounds like, whether you're shed hunting or, or scouting, how are you using HuntStand annually?
One of the biggest aspects that I use it in is always looking ahead to the next area I want to hunt. Yeah. Because you're going to hit a roadblock. And I do the journaling. In fact, I use that same word aspect like you do, but for me, it's more of, especially on public land hunting, you're always hitting a roadblock. You're either running into more people, you're running into rugged country, you're running into some type of obstacle where you need to look ahead. And having that ability to look at a satellite image right there on your phone, and then add in a 3D aspect, a topographical aspect, the natural atlas aspect to see where the nearest trail access might be. If you're, say you're looking 3 miles over a mountain and you're wondering, well, do I need to, hike the 3 miles from right here, or can I come back door it in another way? That's probably the biggest way that I utilize it overall. Now, there's so many ways to use HuntStand. I mean, we could talk for hours on it sitting here, but I really, really use it to look ahead, get a jump start ahead, and try to invigorate myself when I'm having a hard public land hunt. And that's more often than not the case these days. You just gotta be always trying to find the next place to look at where you're gonna find, especially elk, because elk are like whitetails. Elk don't stay in one place. They're what they call a long-legged courser, and that means they cover a heck of a lot of country when and where they want to.
Yeah, that makes sense. So when it comes to, like, I have a feeling we use it in similar ways, just like a lot of the users do. But when it comes to always looking for the next thing, and I know this is species dependent because every species has a specific environment that they're looking at. But from a generalization standpoint, is there things that you are looking for that next hunt or that next, like right now I'm hunting area A, but if this goes bad, I need to be prepared for area B. What are you looking for specifically on area B? Says, hey, I gotta make sure it has these things.
Well, whether I'm hunting, a Midwest whitetail or mountain elk, I always look at the basics. I try to break everything down to the basics, and that's food, water, and refuge. So you're looking for those three things, whether I'm in Kansas or whether I'm in Montana. I'm trying to find those three things because all animals need that. Now, it varies, obviously, depending on species.
Yeah.
But the other thing I'm using a lot, especially if I'm hunting an area I've hunted before, is the journal aspect. And I'm going back to all the icons that I've put in, the rub marks, the scrape marks. Did I find a food source here? And I'm trying to connect.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
I'm sorry about that. I thought I had my phone on silent. You ready again?
Yeah. One, two, right. Three.
Sorry. So I always try to focus on the basics to begin with. I just knock everything down to food, water, refuge, whether it's whitetails or elk, even coyotes when I'm coyote hunting. If I'm having a tough time trying to figure out where these animals are. And you can use your journaling, especially if you have hunted this area from the past, by looking at, you know, past icons you put on there, whether it's scrapes, rubs, water sources you found, food sources you found. Even if you know the neighbor's got a food plot, you should be marking stuff like that because even though you can't hunt it, the deer might be using it. So when things go bad, I backtrack. I start looking at all those things. Where do the lines connect to? And do I need to change my focus because of that? In the fall, a really good, you know, a real good example is the fact that the harvest is going on. So these soybeans may be being used by a herd of bachelor groups, you know, or a whole herd of whitetails. And then all of a sudden a combine comes through, takes the whole field out. And the way they efficiently farm these days, there's not much there to grub on anymore. So then that whole group of deer may move a mile and a half to a different food plot that's still green.
Yeah.
So those are things you got to look at. And same way with elk. If you're chasing a big herd of elk, they need a lot of grass. They're grazers. They're not browsers like moose and whitetails. So you got to find fairly good openings of grass for 20, 30 head or more of elk to graze on. So I'm always kind of looking at that. Where are these elk aren't going to be able to fuel themselves on a dark north slope with pine needles. They've got to have a place to come out on, feed in the grass, and then escape back into.
Yeah.
So I use hunt stand a lot for that. That's, again, you're using your old, icons, what old information you put on there, and trying to move forward to a new spot.
Yeah. So you hunt on a lot of public ground, right?
Out west I do.
Yeah.
My Midwest hunting is basically, I've got some connections where we're hunting farms and
right.
ranches.
Right. So let me ask you this. When it comes to, and I know that you just kind of went through the high level part of it. So in certain areas, and this is one thing that I'm struggling with in South Dakota, is there's a lot of public land, right? And I'm looking for stuff that, and I live in Iowa, which means that I can't necessarily get out there and scout it. Just from a time perspective, right? I pretty much go there and I hunt for my, you know, my 6 to 8 days, depending on, you know, what I'm seeing. And then I got to head back home. So it's hard to get out there and scout during the off season, just because I'm putting all my eggs in the hunting season basket. How do you go about narrowing down public land to find, you know, in a scenario where there's potentially hundreds of thousands of acres to choose from?
It almost always boils down to access.
Yeah.
Finding limited access areas where you have a big chunk of land, and typically I like it to be 2 to 4 square miles of a block of country that is hard to access.
Yeah.
That it's either hard to access because of vertical elevation, rugged topography, the sheer distance. But and I go back, this is a figure I throw around a lot in my articles, but 70 to 74% of the American public is obese or overweight. So the hunting group falls into that.
Yeah.
And maybe hunters are just a little bit less than that, you know, but I don't know. I've been to a lot of deer camps. 70 to 74% of that group is not going 1 mile
right.
past the trailhead.
Right. Right.
So you got to deal with 25%, and those guys burn out after 2 or 3 days. My typical hunting partner quits, changes to a different area, or leaves by day 4 in the mountains of when we're elk hunting.
Gotcha.
And I feel that's an average hunter too.
Yeah. So let me ask you this. When it comes to Like, and I've seen it firsthand. I went on an elk hunt in Idaho, and man, we from the trailhead to about a mile or two in, and I say it 2 miles in because it was easy to access 2 miles in. It wasn't like up and down, up and down, up and down. I mean, it was one slight incline, and you had to go down a little bit, then back up, but it wasn't crazy like certain parts in Colorado were. So, but when we got to that point, there was the topography changed, and we had to make a decision. We have to drop down almost 1,000 feet and then go up almost 1,000 feet to get to where the elk were at, and we didn't do it, right? So have you seen any type of, I don't know, a magic number or like once people, the pressure shuts off, is it just like the next ridge over is when people, when you start seeing the game, or is there a scientific method to locating where they're living?
No, it's all based on the overall environment. And it goes back to those basics. They'll run from you 3 miles in a snap of a finger to get away from you, but they may have to come back a mile and a half to start getting back into grazing or get to that north slope where they felt safe earlier once the hunting pressure, if the hunting pressure starts to lessen up.
Yeah.
And so it's all based on environment. But one number, and you mentioned it right there, that 1,000 foot number, most of my ascents where I leave a trailhead and try to climb up to where the elk are over 1,000. They're probably average closer to 1,500. And that number almost always 1,000 to 1,500 cancels out everyone.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a scary number.
I mean,
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's definitely a scary number when you're talking to a guy like me, right? Where it literally takes me 24 plus hours to acclimate before, like, so, and I'll share this with you. When I did go on that Idaho hunt in 2014, we drove 19 hours from Iowa to Idaho, got out of the car, changed clothes, didn't acclimate at all, and just started hiking straight up the mountain. And I was mentally defeated on the hike in for that whole trip because I had no idea what to expect. Now, when I went to Colorado, you know, we stayed down for a night, then we went up to the cabin, packed, like got the camp set up and at 10,000 feet. And I was able to acclimate for, I don't know, a total of 18 hours, let's say, before I started hunting. And that saved my body pretty much. So when I hear someone say, oh, no, the only thing we have to do is hike up 1,000 feet. I can already feel my butt cheeks burning when you get to that point. So that pretty much then in your opinion eliminates most of the pressure at that point.
2 miles or 1,000 to 1,500 feet typically gets rid of the majority of the folks. You get those 20-year-olds, tough 20-year-olds, and then a handful of guys in their 30s, 40s, and 50s that stay in shape.
But, yeah. Yeah. The rest of them are just kind of road hunters at that point.
Yeah. And you see that the ATV traffic is just off the charts, stupid anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, everybody wants to hear a shortcut or a trick that somebody can implement to make living in, like, or make hunting a mule deer or hunting an elk in certain environments easier. But it sounds to me like the biggest obstacle is the terrain. Is there other than an ATV, is there a way to beat the terrain to get to the game?
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Buy a guided hunt on a ranch where they'll drive you around in a truck.
So just have $8,000 available.
Eight or 10 or 12.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, mule deer hunts are getting more expensive than elk hunts, big mule deer.
Yeah.
You know, the one shortcut is to sleep in elk, stay there, take a bivvy and stay a couple days so you're not going back and forth. I do a lot of back and forth to my base camp. My typical morning is 3 a.m. on the four wheeler by four, whatever, something, drive an hour on the four wheeler and then hike in an hour to an hour and a half, to get to my spot right at shooting light.
Yeah.
That's how I typically hunt. But to me, if I'm not into bugling elk by 5 o'clock in the afternoon, I don't stay usually.
Yeah.
I mean, if you get the occasional straggler satellite that'll light up, but most herds of elk, they get restless around 3, 4, 5 in the afternoon and they get on their feet. And the minute those cows start getting on their feet, that bull bugles. In some areas they might not because of pressure, but even in, I've hunted a lot of areas now. If when things start stirring in the afternoon, you're going to hear a bugle typically. And if I don't hear that bugle, I usually think, well, I want to get a good night's sleep and hit another spot in the morning.
So, yeah. So are you an afternoon, like, would you prefer afternoon or morning on elk?
I'm a morning guy. I've killed almost all my elk in the morning.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like I said, if I'm not getting into elk, I figure, I mean, I'm a little bit older guy too. So I just don't have that 20-year-old run and gun mentality anymore. But I figure if I'm not into elk, things don't look good. I'd rather get a good night's sleep and do a hard morning. And I catch those elk a lot of times. The last couple of years rifle hunting, my success is 2 minutes, if not 5 minutes, of shooting light, and those elk were just about ready to be gone for the day in dark timber.
Yeah.
So. And then sometimes if it's too nice, they don't have to come out until after dark. You know, this is post rut bulls, but, and like I said, during the rut here coming up, if I don't hear bugling by late afternoon, I'm not sitting there till, you know, elk hunting is kind of like turkey hunting. The days are long. So you can just burn yourself out just trying to hunt, you know, dawn and dusk real hard.
Yeah.
So I try to throw all my eggs in the morning basket. I hunt in the afternoon. If I get into bugling bulls, I'll follow them till the end of shooting light. But if I don't, I just don't feel like, why should I be sitting up here beating myself up and get rejuvenated and hit another spot in the morning?
Yeah, for sure. Does that then, when it comes to elk, you've just kind of, you've come up with what kind of works for you. And if it goes outside of that plan, then you've found it best to get back, get a good night's sleep and hit it hard the next morning instead of going and searching and spending a ton of energy looking for something that may not exist.
Correct. And I have the flexibility. So I'm a freelance journalist.
Yeah.
I just pound my office from the time I get back from hunting season, starting in December sometime, until this morning. I mean, I put in tons of hours in the office. I'm usually at my desk or in my office by between 4 or 5 in the morning. In the afternoons, I'm either working out or shooting, getting weapons prepped and ready to go, camp stuff ready to go, whatever. And so for like 9 months of the year, I'm just a working maniac.
Yeah.
So I can have that flexibility. Now, you might not be able to do that, or the regular working man can. And that's right. And you mentioned it, and I'll say it again. And this is specifically public land hunting, is It's physically demanding. You're going to burn yourself out, and I do it all the time. In fact, I'm excited to go hunting, but in the same sense, I know what's ahead. It's grueling.
Yeah.
And you mentally get burnt out. And that's a huge aspect I think people don't think about, is you have got to stay on your mental game. And that's where the sleep comes into me. If I can get, you know, every 2 or 3 days, get a real good night's sleep instead of trying to catch up on sleep, laying on a pine cone in a rock and whatever, you know, middle of the day somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. That's one thing that I realized in my first couple trips was we would go hard, right? Every day. And then I realized that about halfway through the trip, and it's just from the standpoint that I don't live in that environment, my body became wore out in the around the 3 day mark, 3 maybe 4 day mark. And so what I would do is I would stay in, or I would stay close to camp for that next morning hunt, and then just relax all day until the next morning's hunt, and then so I had this a big period of rest, and then I could get up and go do it again, and it would basically not necessarily bring me back up to 100% like pre-hunt, but it would give me enough energy to keep going and not necessarily fade out and almost like give up towards the end.
Right. And I said that earlier, yeah. You know, a lot of my partners burn out at 4 or 5 days, and that's what's going on.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, you said elk kind of get you, right? What is it about elk that you're so passionate about?
Well, since I was young, I grew up in corn country in eastern South Dakota, not too far from Iowa. In fact, I killed a lot of deer right on the Minnesota border.
Yeah.
Literally, I'd look into Minnesota. But my family bought a property in the Black Hills of South Dakota, and we started summering there when I was 10 years old. We'd go out there and spend, you know, weeks, and then we started deer hunting, and then my parents took us on vacations out west. All that just suckered me into the fact that I love the West. So I love I love the habitat, and I really, once I got out here and started looking around in Wyoming, you know, where I live now, I don't know. It's kind of like an addiction. I look at a piece of country and I'll just say, I can do that. I can go in there. I can go in there hunting. I can go in there and pick up some shed elk antlers and get out by myself. So I almost do everything exclusively solo now.
Yeah.
And that's become, I don't know, a goofy challenge of mine, but I do have some friends. I'm meeting a guy in 2 days now for my elk hunt, but I suspect he'll be gone, you know, in 4, 5, 6 days, and I'll be solo again. But almost all my elk, all of them, in fact, in the last 10 years, I've killed solo and packed them out solo, except for last year, the last load, I got my neighbor kid to meet me. We went up on the mountain, and he helped me pack out the last, it was the last 3/4 of an elk. We broke it down. I took out one pack and had three loads of meat ready to go. And we went in and took those three, combined them into two, and packed them.
Yeah. Yeah. That's physically demanding. Talk about that. Like, a lot of the people who listen to this are Midwestern hunters, right? Talk about, like, walking in may be difficult, but walking out with potentially over 70, close to 100 pounds of meat on your back is a different story. What's that actually like?
Horrible. It's people have to, the hunting is cool.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, like I said, it's still a grind. It can be grueling, but you really have to look, for one thing, you get excited too, and young people do this all the time. They'll chase elk into hell holes.
Yeah.
Well, you got to remember, if you're chasing an elk down into a 1,000-foot canyon, you got to come back up out of that if you kill him with that first 100 load on, 100 pounds on, and then two to three more, depending on how you break him down. But and then you got to be ready for that. Yeah. Some people just don't really understand the whole aspect of I need a kill kit with me. You know, I need the game bags, knife sharpener, latex gloves. Maybe I carry garbage bags. I use bag liner, put that in my backpack as a bag liners to minimize blood, you know, different stuff like that. You got to be ready for that. You got to have a couple light sources. If you kill them late in the day, you're going to be doing all this at dark. And like I said, I kill most of my bulls in the morning, but I killed one several years ago, right at dark in Montana with a bull, and broke him down in the dark. And the next morning I come in, there was a bear on that carcass. So a bear might come in on you in the dark. So you got to be ready for that. I mean, there's, but you got to be in shape. It's one thing to be in shape to go into country with a minimal backpack, just your first aid, survival gear, lunch, a layer of clothes. It's a whole nother thing to come out with 100 pounds on your back. And especially if there's any type of terrain involved.
Yeah. And so that was my big mistake on my first ever elk hunt was, hey, if I go hit the gym and I just lift a whole bunch of weights, I'll be ready. Well, I may have been strong, but I was not conditioned. And so I think that's where I had to learn, right? Like, you know, just because you can squat and bench press and, you know, deadlift, that doesn't mean that you can walk uphill for all day long. You know what I mean? For, you know, in thin air to be ready for that. And I learned my lesson the hard way for sure.
Yeah, I call it mountain conditioning.
Yeah.
I have a little gym in my basement, but if and when I can, I'm usually out in the mountains. And if people would see me, you know, you'd meet me on the street or whatever, you wouldn't say, "Oh man, there's the next Arnold Schwarzenegger." Or something. I'm not that, but
right.
It's just, you're right. I mean, it's just conditioned to the environment. I live at half the elevation I hunt. I live at 4,000 feet. So, yeah. You know, jumping up to 8,000, 9,000 feet or even higher isn't, you know, it doesn't affect me hardly at all.
Yeah.
So I think that there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, you can be gym tough, but there's a big difference between gym tough and mountain tough. I know that.
Yeah, for sure. All right. So now when it comes to the terrain, right, you hunt mule deer as well. I know that elk terrain in certain areas can be pretty difficult. But from the buddies that I know, let's say, for example, I'll just use Colorado as an example. Colorado, where we were hunting, has some pretty intense terrain, and the elk are up high, but the mule deer seem to be just up a little bit higher or further back or whatever. From your experience, is there a terrain difference and how do I put this? A harder terrain to access on elk versus mule deer?
Well, again, it all depends on the landscape you're hunting. I hunt eastern Montana, and that's, you know, fairly rolling pine covered bluffs and hills.
Yeah.
So the mule deer and elk there, I mean, it can get rugged, but it's not like going into the Bighorn Mountains here where I hunt, or the Snowy Range, maybe down in southern Wyoming, or over by, you know, on the east side of the Yellowstone, or up in the thoroughfare. That can be really steep and rough. So it depends on environment. I have found, though, that elk and or mule deer in pressured areas go into the steepest stuff possible. Very, very vertical stuff. And in mine, where I do a lot of my hunting, and they use that vertical separation to separate themselves from hunters. And not only hunters, or rifle hunters, bow hunters, I see them doing the same thing with shed hunters now. You know, shed hunting's gotten so popular.
Yeah. So,
and they're in stuff a lot of times you would think is bighorn sheep country.
Yeah. It's funny you say that because I was in South Dakota this, Nebraska this last summer, and we were out in the grasslands and we ran into some bighorn sheep. They had been reintroduced there. They all had, a couple of them had collars on. And so it was cool to see, because when I thought of bighorn sheep, I just instantly thought of the most aggressive, rocky terrain possible. And here they are on a hill in the grasslands. So it was pretty cool to see that.
Yeah, they're like, I suppose, like elk in a way. They will go out into the Great Plains as well. I mean, yeah. The Badlands of South Dakota has bighorn sheep in it. And a lot of times we see them as just on these little grassy plateaus grazing.
Yeah. Gotcha. All right. So you've talked a little bit about, you know, how much you really like, elk hunting. Now when it comes to mule deer, some guys hunt certain species. For example, I hunt turkey because I can't hunt deer at that time of year, or, you know, it's like something to do when it's not deer hunting. When it comes to like mule deer or whitetail, do you have the same passion towards those animals, or is it just something to do to keep the hunting fire lit because you can't hunt elk?
No, I have a similar passion for everything. And gotcha. I mean, I grew up, like I said, I cut my teeth on whitetails. So going into the Midwest and hunting whitetails, you know, that rocks my world too. Rattling them in, grunting them in, decoying them in. I love all those aspects of it. And mule deer, a lot of my mule deer hunting is in the edge of the mountains and more in the sagebrush. But trying to map out a way. And again, here you can use your hunt stand, but you know, you see a mule deer out there, maybe a mile in the distance, and then you got to figure out, you know, the terrain. Am I going to be able to keep out of sight that entire distance to get to him for a spot and stalk hunt? And that becomes the real challenge. And then I do a lot of predator hunting. I love calling in coyotes. I got a dog that usually goes with me, kind of a decoy dog, I would say. And that's another turn on. I get to, you know, take my dog out with me and do a lot of vocalizations, act like we are coyotes or angry canines to try to get another canine to interact with you.
Yeah, cool.
Each thing has its own, you know, attraction, allure. I do a lot of turkey hunting too.
Yeah.
But there's one thing I put aside everything for, and that's, I just really enjoy shed antler hunting.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's because I don't have the pressure of I've got to fill the freezer at that time of year. It's kind of more of a, you know, an escape, kind of a fun hunt. You're looking at the country at a different time of year than you normally would be. And then it's the world's biggest Easter egg hunt.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'll tell you this, man, when I was younger, I would shed hunt a lot. And I absolutely loved shed hunting. But recently, and you know, here in Iowa, because back in the day, nobody cared if you were shed hunting, like on their property. Hey, can I go shed hunt your property? You're telling me you want to go look for deer antlers? Yeah, you can go do that, right? And so I have this collection of shed antlers that I found throughout the years. And as I started having kids and it became harder to access ground here in Iowa, shed hunting has kind of taken a back seat as far as the time that I've put into it. But I can definitely see how, you know, just putting the boots to the ground on, you know, on some public ground would just be, out west specifically, would just be amazing.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the 7-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. And it's fun when you can escape the crowds and just like I said, go climb a, you know, a 1500 foot cliff face to get away from everybody, and bam, you're by yourself. This year I didn't run into one person in the backcountry at all. I saw boot tracks here or there, but it was really a nice spring where typically you're seeing people here and there, but I didn't run into one person, just me and my dog the whole spring. So.
Yeah. What is it about shed hunting that you like so much?
I honestly don't. I'm just an antler nut. I love antlers. I got them laying everywhere in my house. I got them outside my yard. I got a big pile outside of my barn. I got a big pile in my barn. I just like the aspect of looking of antlers. And then, like I said, it's just a unique challenge to find them. But the one thing I have learned over all the years of shed hunting, I've done it for decades now, and same thing, it's changed, you know, from when I started, nobody cared, to now you can't hardly even get on private land.
Yeah.
But the one thing I've learned is it is a huge eye opener to scouting and being ready for the hunting season. A lot of the elk country I shed hunt in is where I hunt. And it's because of what I've learned shed hunting that I feel like I'm more successful as a hunter.
Yeah.
So, And our elk migrate, but but there's certain zones that they don't go in and they don't leave.
Yeah.
Or they pass through at a certain time. And that shed hunting has just really opened my eyes to hidden benches in on a super steep face. You know, you can look at those topographical lines on your Hunt Stand app or 3D or using the 3D mode, but walking with boots on the ground, all of a sudden you see, oh yeah, here's a line of dugout beds. These elk were on this bench all fall, and you can tell because there was a whole line of rubs there. Every time they get up out of their bed, they made a new rub. So
yeah.
And I see the same thing whitetail hunting. You're down in some dense thicket and it's like, holy cow, these deer are spending a lot of time in here. And then you start looking at your hunting app and connecting the dots again. And it's like, well, why wouldn't they be? It leads right out to the edge of this cornfield, you know, a half a mile away. And they're putting that much distance between for safety from food to bedding cover.
Yeah, absolutely. In 2018, man, I used a shed where I found a shed specifically in that location to another, I guess you want to call it, I had a trail camera there. So using the hunting app per se, I dropped a line from where I found the shed to where that I got a picture of that deer, and I set up in a terrain feature where, right where that line crossed over. And sure enough, that night I went in there, first time I went into that location on the right wind direction that I needed, he showed up and I shot him, and now he's hanging on my wall. So I can actually say that I have used a shed that actually helped me kill a buck that I was chasing. So it was, it's just another piece of information is all it is.
Yep. That's exactly. A little bit more evidence.
Yep. Absolutely. Now, you've mentioned you got Montana this year. You got Kansas this year. You got Wyoming this year. Any other hunts on the schedule that this year that you're really looking forward to?
South Dakota rifle. I'm going to do that right before Thanksgiving. And I look forward to that because I'm hunting with one of my best friends, and we stay at his house. We hunt his family ranch, and some other places he has access to. And it's just a really fun hunt. And then, Kansas is the same way. I hook up with some buddies. I spend so much time alone in the mountains, in the fall hunting that it's nice to go back to some of these, and they're just small. It's just two or three of us, you know?
Yeah.
But it's just a nice hunting camp scenario where, you know, if it's raining hard, you get up in the morning, you don't want to go sit in a tree stand. You make pancakes and hang out or whatever.
Right. Right.
But if it's not raining, you know, then we're out hard, you know, hunting and chasing deer or snowing or whatever. And so those hunts I'm looking forward to. I used to always want to shoot the biggest deer, and I still do, but I use common sense anymore. Same with public land elk, you know, it's like, you see a good representative animal, you better be making hay with it and enjoying the overall hunt.
Yeah.
And another thing I do when I'm on those hunts, if I can tag out early, I always bring my coyote hunting setup and try to call coyotes for, you know, a couple mornings, again, wherever I'm at.
Yeah. I'll tell you this. I have never seriously been a predator hunter, but I got some friends who live in Missouri, and they might love coyote hunting more than they love deer hunting. They absolutely love it. And so I'm still wondering how I could love something more than deer hunting, but I feel like that would be another avenue to just extend the season to almost all year round, and to do it with kids.
Do with kids. And the other thing again is, you know, coyote hunting's gotten tougher with all the people out there nowadays, but I make them scouting trips too. Every time I go out, you know, coyote hunting, it's get out there at daybreak, whether I'm calling coyotes then or behind, got my eye behind the spot scope looking at mule deer, or elk, or whitetails. In our country, we've got all three intermixed. So,
yeah, absolutely.
It's a great time to be scouting as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you said you got Kansas kind of, you're learning Kansas, or you kind of got Kansas nailed down, or you're thinking about it more. Why Kansas over other whitetail states?
Well, it goes back to elk hunting. I met a couple guys in an elk camp in Colorado years ago, and they had property in Kansas for whitetails and invited me down there. And we've been good friends ever since. So that's one reason. A, I got a connection. I got an open door, open gates to go hunt their properties.
Yeah.
And B, Kansas has giant whitetails.
Yeah.
I mean, it's that simple. And they allow you to bait. I'm not going to sit here and say, you know, oh, well, you know, we're hunting just rattling and all that. I do everything, but that baiting is a big aspect. It helps keep a group of deer in a certain area over and over again. And so when the rut occurs, you have these, and food plots do the same thing, you know, and actually almost every bait we have set up on these farms is sitting right in the middle of the food plot.
Yeah.
So, but that surely helps. Those deer will come in, they'll get some corn, they're going to hit the alfalfa or the winter wheat or the turnips, whatever is on the food plot. And it's just a constant revolving door, especially when you get that so-called lockdown period going on. At least you have these areas where does are returning. And when a buck gets done breeding an estrus doe, his first trip is going to be come back to that food source.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Well, I tell you what, man, I really appreciate you taking time out of your day. I know you were busy today packing for your trips that you got coming up. So I really appreciate you taking time out of your day to sit and BS with me for a little bit. Thank you very much. And let me be one of the first to say good luck this season. Hopefully you'd lay down and slay.
I'm hoping to get at least one elk in the freezer. It's just a great source of meat. It's tasty, and then just supplement it with deer. So that's my goal every year: get an elk, have a couple deer, and eat well the rest of the winter. Amen. But I really appreciate you inviting me on. I
mean, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
It's a privilege. I always love to talk to the folks about hunting, whether it's and if people have questions ever, they can go to my website at markkaiser.com, and it has links there to Facebook and Instagram are the two I do the most. So yeah, they can go on there, and I'll, you know, if I'm not in the back country or something, I'll try to get back to people right away if they got questions or comments or something. I try to answer it as much as I can.
So. Yeah, absolutely. Cool. All right. Well, appreciate your time and good luck this season.
Thank you. You have a good hunting season too, Dan.
Huge shout out to Mark. Huge shout out to all of you for taking time out of your day to listen to this podcast. Hopefully, you guys enjoyed it. Please go to iTunes, leave a 5-star review, and let everybody know how awesome this podcast is. Follow along on Nine Finger Chronicles on Instagram. And I'll tell you what, guys, it's hunting season now, right? And so this episode may have been recorded a little earlier. And so all of September's gone now, but it is the time of year where we all need to start thinking and putting plans together to getting out into the woods, specifically us whitetail hunters, and getting the job done. So planning, preparation, making sure you have your safety harness, and of course, good vibes in, good vibes out, and we'll talk to you next time.